Welcome to On Mic, conversations from Northgate Hall, home of the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. I'm Ed Wasserman, Dean of the School. As one of the nation's top journalism programs, we regularly invite the world's best reporters, writers, and documentarians to talk about the stories behind their stories. This time, war and conflict journalist Mark Danner.
At the same time as you lightened that war and ended it, or at the time it was ended, of course it's now expanded again, but you also expanded the war on terror to other countries where it hadn't been before.
Mark Danner has covered political affairs and wars around the world for over 30 years. He now serves as Chancellor's Professor of Journalism and English at UC Berkeley. In part one of her interview with Danner, lecturer Deirdre English sits down with him to discuss his latest book, Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. It's On Mic, Deirdre English in conversation with Mark Danner.
So Mark is an unsparing and eloquent writer, and I would love to get us started with I'm going to ask him to read something in a moment, but welcome, Mark Danner.
Thank you. Thank you, Deirdre. It's good to be here.
I'd love for you to start by reading the very first section of Spiral, and then we'll talk a little bit about why you chose to start this way.
Sure. I came upon the half-destroyed truck atop a highway overpass outside Fallujah. The cab shot to hell, the trailer blood-stained and propped up at a crazy angle on its blown tires. On the highway below, a great black burn scarred the concrete, and over it a rust-red slash, the soot and blood marking the spot where, earlier that day, in October 2003, the insurgents had used a cheap remote control to ignite barrels of concealed explosives just as the U.S. Armor Patrol rumbled by, killing one paratrooper, wounding several. Insurgents, hidden in houses nearby, followed with bursts from their AK-47s. The Americans promptly dismounted and with their M-16s and M-4s began pouring lead into everything they could see, starting with the truck that happened to be passing on the highway above, eviscerating the unfortunate driver, and then fired into the houses. How many Iraqis had the troops killed and wounded? The more the better, as far as insurgent leaders were concerned. Quote, "The point is to get the Americans to fire back," the commanding general of the 82nd Airborne told me the next day, "and hopefully the bad guys will get some Iraqi casualties out of that and they can publicize that," unquote. By week's end, scores of family and close friends of those killed and wounded would join the insurgents, for honor demanded they kill Americans to wipe away family shame. American firepower plus Iraqi deaths equals more insurgents, an axiom in the strategy of provocation. Provoke your enemy to kill civilians and thereby call to battle the sleeping population. You have no army? Use the aggression of the occupiers to help raise one of your own. In Iraq, insurgents have used that strategy to grow and prosper, recognizing the characteristic American quickness to react with overwhelming firepower as their best friend. Across continents, Al-Qaeda used it as well, blowing up towers in New York to create an indelible recruiting poster for the worldwide cause while provoking self-defeating responses. Lure the Americans into Afghanistan, where they'll sink into the quagmire that had trapped their superpower rival two decades before. Such was Osama bin Laden's strategy.
Thank you. Well, you know, a key sentence in that introduction is, the point is to get the Americans to fire back.
Mm-hmm.
And that connects to the title of your book, Spiral. So can you make the connection for us between the title of your book and that phrase, the key is to get the Americans to fire back?
Yeah, the spiral image is something obviously going in a circle, spiraling around and never ending. And that goes with the image of the forever war, the endless war, and it speaks directly to what the purpose of the attacks on the United States were and how the U.S. has responded. Because I think only if you look at the purpose and the response can you judge the decisions that American leaders have made in the war and judge whether indeed the war broadly conceived, the war against terror, if you want to put it that way, has been successful. And I think it escapes most Americans, in part because of the government rhetoric on the issue, that these attacks were designed to provoke responses. That is that terrorism is the strategy of the weak. You use terrorism to provoke a stronger adversary to react in a way that will help you build your movement, that will help you politically. And al-Qaeda did that by striking the towers in New York and provoking counterattacks on Afghanistan and Iraq. And the Iraqi insurgents did it at the time that scene took place that I read in 2003 to help grow the insurgency and help grow the movement against the U.S. occupiers, which grew from a very small movement, so far as we can tell, to an overwhelmingly powerful one that essentially won the war, if you look at it in the broad sense of then the rise of ISIS and so on. They used Americans' own firepower, striking back at Iraqis, to help gain Iraqi support. And I think that even though this is a fairly simple principle and is common to many, many insurgencies, Americans in general don't understand it. Very smart Americans who follow foreign affairs and so on don't really understand this basic mechanism, this strategy of provocation, which underlines both the Iraq War and, as I said, the broader war on terror. So it seems to me that it was critical to set out this strategy in a very clear way in order to then judge the broader war on terror and why it has become an endless war. And a lot of that has to do with U.S. response, not just the original attacks.
Yes. And so you show it in the first paragraphs of your book that you just read in a microcosm. And then I think in the book, you really are looking at the macrocosm of trying to take that and writ large and putting it into historical context over the decades to see that this, you know, this what is happening in these details is what also has been happening to our countries on a very large scale as we have fallen into this forever war that we don't seem to be able to get out of. Well, let's talk a little bit about also the contrast in terms of journalism and what journalists can do. Because another really important feature of the war in Vietnam was that there were a lot of freelance journalists, writers like John Schell, for example, or writers who had been themselves soldiers, Hare, for example.
Right.
And a lot of people who may worked for mainstream media but had a tremendous freedom to just go around in Vietnam on their own, not necessarily embedded. And they were able to bring back a story that wasn't the official story. And that was a huge part of the Vietnam resistance phenomenon. Now, how has it been for journalists in the forever war?
Well, you know, I think Vietnam, and it's interesting, we just read in my class on foreign war coverage, Bang Bang Abroad. We read Michael Hare and Jonathan Schell as well.
Oh, wait a minute. That's the name of your class, Bang Bang Abroad?
Bang Bang Abroad.
For a moment, I thought it was the name of a book.
No.
That's
the name of the class, the humor of which most people seem to miss. I think it's a good title. But we've been, we were deep into Dispatches, Michael Hare's great book. And we also read, suggested reading, The Village of
Ben Sook,
which is Jonathan Schell's great work, extraordinary piece of writing, which he did when he was, I don't know, 24, I think. It was his first piece, which is just hard to get your head around. And it's true that, you know, looking back on it now, Vietnam, when it came to the freedom that correspondents were given and took advantage of, there's nothing to compare it to, really. I mean, they simply, you know, got on helicopters, got off. If a helicopter was going to Khe Sanh, they could hop on, they could hop off. They didn't have to go to any sort of press officer and get permission. They talked to, they were almost wholly unrestricted in who they talked to. I mean, it's really extraordinary. And of course, it was a generation, too, that was baby boom generation. The reporters I'm talking about. And you had just an exemplary group of people. You know, from Halberstam, Frankie Fitzgerald, Charlie Moore, you know, you can give a whole list. There has not been since then a comparative freedom. There simply hasn't been.
Yeah. And don't you think that those circumstances in some ways produced great journalism? Because journalists would be on the scene and they could compare the experiences that they could compare what they saw with their own eyes to the official story and then they saw the lies.
Absolutely. I think that's true. I think, though, it bears remembering that there were also a lot of people who didn't. You know, the journalism that we and this is again goes back to periodicity and so on, that the journalism we prize and that's gathered in the Library of America, you know, reporting Vietnam, two-volume set and so on, are those who went out, in the way you're saying, went out and compared the official line that they were given at the 5 o'clock follies in Saigon, the official briefings, to what they saw on the ground and also what soldiers, grunts, told them. There were a fair number of people who went and reported what was told to them. And, you know, there's a fascinating book by David Halberstam, actually, Powers That Be, that's about the difference between editors in New York, essentially, and reporters in the field when it comes to Vietnam. It's a great, wonderful book, not as well known as The Best and the Brightest, although it deserves to be. But reporting on the Forever War, I think, is very different. I mean, you know, originally in the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, you had considerable control by the military of reporters who were joining them, embedded, that awful term, because, so, you know, reporters have always been together with the military. We just developed the term embedded rather late. But they were restricted in ways that they weren't in Vietnam. That's absolutely true. It's certainly true.
Well, the term embedded just seems almost to imply in bed with.
Exactly. It's a terrible term.
Yeah.
And it bespeaks a truth, which is that when you're with a certain military unit, you're dependent on them for personal protection.
Yeah.
So during the actual invasion, I think the reporting, if you look back at the reporting of the actual invasion, which is, say, the 3 weeks that it took for the U.S. to go from the border of Kuwait to Baghdad, one of the things that's missing from that reporting is the scale of the killing. You know, there were probably 10,000 civilians killed in that period. And most Americans, I think if you talk to them now, had no idea of that. The AP did a piece in which they recorded 3,200 hospital deaths of civilians, which dramatically understates the numbers because most people didn't die in hospitals, of course. But this was just civilians, not Iraqi soldiers. And that's a huge part of the war, the carnage that took place in the actual march to Baghdad was extreme. And, you know, Americans basically who watched Ted Koppel in his tank helmet and so on, none of that was on American television. None of that was in – most of that was not in the American press. And I think part of that is a result of the way the press was controlled. You know, people will – I mean, this should be, needless to say, someone should do a study on this and really try to nail it down. But I think what I say is broadly true. Now, the Forever War, such as it is limited in its reporting by other things. One is that in several of the countries that are part of the Forever War, Libya, for example, Yemen, most of the U.S. participation in the Forever War is drones and counterinsurgency special forces. Neither of those get covered really at all. I mean, there is no American reporter.
Well, let's actually break that down a little bit more in terms of time. I think, you know, for the benefit of students who will listen to this podcast, a little bit of a primer on how things went from 9/11 to today,
right,
you know, might be helpful. And in explaining the switches that did occur even as the spiral kept on growing.
Sure. I think, you know, you mentioned Obama and the Obama administration. You mentioned the Obama administration is what most of our students would remember vividly. And a good part of Spiral, the first half is about Bush and the beginnings of the Forever War during the 8 years that Bush was in power. But a good part of the second part is really about Obama.
And Obama ran on an anti-war platform.
He did.
Obama ran saying that the war in Iraq had been a mistake.
Mm-hmm. He opposed it from the beginning.
He made it clear that he felt that it was important for him to run, not Hillary, at that time, the first time he ran for office, because he was someone who could end the war, and Hillary was someone who had voted for the war, although she later said it had been a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
But Hillary was portrayed as fairly, I think, as a hawk compared to Obama.
Right.
So Obama ran to end the war, bring the troops home, de-escalate, stop the spiral. He clearly saw the spiral that you talk about.
Absolutely. He did. And when, as I describe in Spiral, when he got into office. In fact, what he did was transform the war. He transformed what were shooting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan into the end of a shooting war in Iraq. He brought the troops mostly home in 2011. He de-escalated. I mean, it's a complicated story about Afghanistan, but at the end, he tried to end it, but he mostly de-escalated until you had 10,000 or so troops. What he did was expand the war at the same time in what could be called his light footprint approach.
And this is what you meant when you were referring a moment ago to drone warfare and special forces,
correct? Exactly. Exactly.
The light footprint.
Mm-hmm. The war expanded in an interesting way. The first way it expanded was it used forces where casualties would be minimal. Drones are the key example of that. He escalated dramatically the use of drones, which, of course, don't put even American pilots at risk because the pilots are sitting in trailers in outside Las Vegas or in Virginia or northern New York. There's not even any exposure on the ground.
It's unbelievable, really.
Mm-hmm. It is unbelievable. It's remarkable. Secondly, of course, there are no reporters to report on it.
Yeah.
And though these strikes get into the press now and again, technically they're secret. Thirdly, you have raids by special operators, JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, which run these raids. They're often at night. They go in. They're rarely American casualties. And they kill, I mean, they're essentially assassination raids. They kill people on the ground. And this war lightened up. In other words, you stopped these heavy divisions, as it were. You took them out of Iraq. But you, at the same time as you lightened that war and ended it, or at the time it was ended, of course, it's now expanded again. But you also expanded the war on terror to other countries where it hadn't been before, including Yemen, including now Libya.
The reason being because they could pinpoint, quote, terrorists or insurgents in other countries, find them and eliminate them without regard to national borders.
Well, supposedly they could. One of the...
The rationale being, yeah.
Yeah, that was the rationale. I mean, I laugh at that because one of the issues that we as a country haven't come to grips with at all is how many of these people we're killing are actually terrorists. And also, if we're killing these people who are members of groups, should we be killing the leaders? Should we be killing all of them? And if you're killing the leaders, since they immediately replace the leaders, how effective is such a so-called decapitation strategy? And one of my theses in the book is that we have created in the war of terror a perpetual motion machine. In other words, that our killing and our drone attacks and our continual expansion of the ground in which we are killing people, even though it's secret to Americans, it's not secret to the people's families who have been killed, for example, we continually do what the passage I read suggests, which is we continually fuel the anger and the political energy which drives these groups forward and encourages them to expand. So we're essentially one necessary part in this machine of terrorism, and we have continued to be that way, and which is why in the later part of that introduction that you asked me to read from, there are some amazing figures from the U.S. State Department, which is that the number of terrorist attacks worldwide under the war on terror have gone up 4,000%. 4,000%. I mean, this remarkable figure. Now, they've not gone up to that degree within the borders of the United States, which means perhaps George W. Bush, for example, might say, well, we're fighting them abroad so we don't have to at home. That might be his response to that. But the fact is that if your way of judging the war on terror is how close are we to ending it? That is, how long will it go on? How long will we have to fight this? The answer to me seems to be we're a lot farther from its ending than we were, paradoxically enough, than we were at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, we keep making it larger rather than smaller.
We've been listening to Mark Danner in conversation with Deirdre English. This has been On Mic, a podcast presentation of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Technical facilities for On Mic are underwritten by the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation. Our producers are Kat Schuknecht and Lee Mengistu. I'm Dean Ed Wasserman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us next time.